Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is the Olive Magazine podcast, a weekly slice of food and drink chat brought to you by the team behind Olive Magazine. I'm Janine, Olive's food director and podcast host, and this is episode 174. This week, deputy food editor Adam went to meet up with chef, restaurateur and author Josh Nyland. Josh has flown all the way over from Sydney to cook from and talk about his new book, The Whole Fish Cookbook, which tackles the unusual subject of fish butchery. They also discuss sustainability, waste, and how his book may change the way we use and consume fish completely on its head.
Hey guys, it's Adam, Olive's deputy food editor, and I'm here with Josh Nyland, who is the author of The Whole Fish Cookbook.
G'day. Hey Josh. How are you?
I'm very well. How about yourself?
Good, very good. Nice to be in London.
Yeah.
Sun's out as well.
The sun is actually out
for
once.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You can stay for a while.
Yeah.
Your book's probably been making some real shockwaves at the moment. Yeah. Could you just tell us a little bit about it, really?
Yeah, I had the great fortune of meeting the good people at Hardy Grant, and they were as enthusiastic about a fish book as I was, even though there was some reluctance there that fish books aren't overly well received, but more so challenging to move at times because the confrontation around fish. So the agenda was to write a book that was expressing, like to me anyway, expressing where fish was up to in the year that we're in now, given the amount of, I suppose, knowledge that's out there, floating out there. But I felt like the dots had never had a line drawn through them.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't, it's not that I feel lucky that I was the one to do it, but I feel like I've had the opportunity to work with extraordinary fish for a long time, and I've had a great level of training from a very basic level to create a good little basin of technique. And then, you know, the opportunity now to expand upon those basic techniques and explore creatively and also apply a lot of common sense to something that I feel like we haven't ever gone back to.
Yeah.
The wheel has turned a certain way with fish for so long, and no one's thought to just put the brake on and then spin it the other way.
Yeah.
So the book was meant to be indicative of where fish is up to.
Yeah, and I think that's the real impression that I got from reading it, was that there's nothing really that you can sort of compare it to in recent years. It tells you exactly like how to cook, like many different ways to cook a fish, but also like new techniques that like that sort of top end restaurants are starting to look at. And we'll talk a bit about, but like fish aging, for example, I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah.
So that's something that I've sort of, I'm on Instagram, so I like, you know, I've been seeing a few people like aging like bream, and you know, you see like what a week aged bream, but I mean, I don't really know anything about it. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah. So dry aging is one of those things where the first time I put a hook through a fish's tail and hung it up, and I took a photo of myself doing so, you know, it was probably met 50-50 with response to negatively and positively.
Yeah.
Some just found it humorous that I was trying to treat fish like meat.
Mm.
And quite a few people said, you know, that's absurd and what are you doing and you can't do that.
Mm.
And so, and then others were very curious. And so the idea with it is not to put a fish on a hook to break down connective tissue, nor to make it taste cheesy or funky as you would a cow.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask. Because like, are you harnessing like fermentation, I suppose, like you do in beef?
Yeah, so I suppose, the idea with it is to take the best quality fish that you can get your hands on. Ideally, it's been ikijimi spiked, mm-hmm. brain spiked, and caught on the line. When it comes through the doors then, we're cutting the scales off the fish. I got to handle some sea bass earlier in the week here in London, and working with a fish that was around, I don't know, anywhere between 1 and 4 kilos. Mm-hmm. So even for fish that I perceive as 1 and 4 kilos is, you know, medium. Like, it was a good size. They were by no means big fish, yeah. like it was one suggests in that book. In yeah. the whole fish book, there's quite a few generously sized species
yeah, yeah.
of fish.
There's some big ones.
Just so that we could actually, you know, give people good perspective on how I go about doing these things. So we cut the scales off the fish, and if we don't have a fish big enough in size, then we'll use either a spoon or a soft scaler just to take off the mm-hmm. scales. Once we've done that, we wipe the scales clear with paper towel. Then we go and we gut the fish. When we gut the fish, we take out the organs. The reason why this is the long way around talking about this dry aging thing is I feel like it's so important to reference we're taking best quality fish.
Yeah.
Then we're not putting any water anywhere near it.
Yeah.
And then we take the organs out, we sort the organs so that we have the opportunity then of utilizing, you know, every single part.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the gills and the gallbladder. And then once the organs are out, we wipe the interior of the cavity out with paper towel again. At that point, once it's all clean and clear, then we put the hook in the tail, we hang it in our cool room. The cool room has no fan blowing inside. The reason for that is a fan would take too much moisture from right. the fish, because the intention is not to dry the fish out. It's not to not offer a succulent, juicy piece of fish right. that we're all craving. The idea is to, throughout time, take away a small amount of moisture from the fish to bring about more oil, more fat, and articulate the flavor of certain species.
Mm-hmm.
Aging isn't for every single fish.
Yeah.
Fish that come through the door may only get 1 to 2 days of storage time because yeah. we feel that after 3 days, after 4 days, they're at their very peak.
Yeah.
But then contrary to that, you know, bigger species of fish like more dense muscle and greater amounts of fat like tuna and swordfish and mackerel, mm-hmm. we can mature for up to a month. Yeah. And that's through not using any salt or preservatives.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to look for like something to draw a parallel. It's almost like a fresh tomato that's almost a bit watery, and then yes. you just like sort of sun dry it for like not to the same extent that it's shriveled or anything.
Yeah.
But like you're just condensing.
Well, you'll notice that a semi dried tomato tastes better than a at times than a good tomato.
Yeah.
But I feel like water is the enemy to fish. But that's the system that we've normalized globally, mm-hmm. both in the East and the West. And
that's for a simpleton like me, that sounds so strange because I'm like, they come from water.
Correct.
But you're talking about like fresh water, like being hosed down, like yes. with the fresh water. And what's the reason for that? Have they got like a natural protection on them from the sea, or like?
Well, they do have a natural protection on them. Like when you see a fish come out of the water, they've got a mucus coating, yeah. and that mucus protects the fish from pathogens like attacking them in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And through, you know, eventually, even if it's correctly handled, that mucus will dissipate and wear away through mm-hmm. time. But water basically, you know, a fish is porous. You know, there's a line of porous scale which sits along the lateral red muscle of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so to put ice directly onto fish post, like to talk about this as well, like when a fish comes out of water, if you don't brain spike the fish,
yeah.
which is, you know, like the majority
yeah.
of fish, then it goes into an ice slurry to yes. get the temperature of the fish down
yeah.
and to make sure that the lactic acid doesn't settle in the muscle, because when that happens, the fish feel it, like the muscle, you know, is compromised, it breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm suggesting that ice is necessary for that purpose of killing the fish correctly.
Right.
But then once it comes out of there and goes into transport and traveling, the importance of cold chain management, of keeping a fish between 0 and 1 degrees, is so critical
mm-hmm.
for a good product. But keep the fish out of ice, not direct anyway. Keep a sheet around it, keep it, you know, separate to it. And then when you go about processing, just stop with the water, because mm-hmm. the water is the second water is hosed over a fish. If a fish is dipped into water, you've set the time with the potential shelf life that you have,
right.
which is that accustomed 2 to 3 to 4 day window
yeah, yeah.
where it's, I suppose, at its at its most tolerated. Mm-hmm. I won't say best.
Yeah.
I feel like to get a little geeky with you, and I don't mean to. Like, fish in the water have an organic compound in them called trimethylamine.
Yeah.
And when a fish dies, it converts into trimethylamine oxide. When that starts breaking down post-mortem, mm-hmm. the fish, like the trimethylamine oxide, converts into ammonia. And ammonia is what fishy fish is. And so that's often a conversation in fish shops around town and things, and that's the first point of call is, what's your least fishy fish?
Yeah, yeah.
And they're referring to the ammonia.
Right.
And the reason, like, the only way to offset ammonia is through using acidic ingredients. Hence why we've got a repertoire of cooking that dates back centuries, where we've got acidic-based ingredients being positioned with fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're delicious with fish, but we're building these recipes with the anticipation that the fish will ultimately be fishy. And I'm suggesting that fishiness and ammonia, you know, the relevance of ammonia with fish, I'm not saying that I can remove that totally, but when a fish of mine, which very rarely happens, but when a fish of mine spoils, you don't have ammonia. You have fat within the fish rancidifying and going sour.
Right.
Because the moisture that used to attach itself to the fat, it's like making a mayonnaise.
Yeah, yeah.
When you run out of moisture and there's too much fat present, the mayonnaise splits.
Yeah.
So the same with fish. When too much moisture is taken away and too much fat is prominent, the fat will spoil and go sour. Whereas water getting thrashed all over fish and, you know, sitting on ice and all of that stuff is rapidly deteriorating fish. Mm-hmm. And the second a fillet comes off the bone, you've activated the fish and there's very little time left that you have to work with something delicious. One other point that I wanted to make was, have you ever walked into a meat butcher where you've seen them breaking down a carcass of an animal and a sirloin comes from a cow? And then it's dipped into a pool of water in front of them and then brought back up, cut a steak, dip the steak back in, and then put that steak on a pan of ice. Do you, like, that's not a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen that happen. So then why is it that we're taking fish from the water and putting it back into water?
Yeah.
Like, that is the only reason why the system does that. And I think the system that we're in celebrates quantity over quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason for the water use, because it brings about great efficiency and speed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and as in all those things you're saying, is that, do you think those processing it, like, is that, do you think why fish has sort of a bad, like a worse rep, or like it's seen as something almost like more dangerous, but completely not? Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah. There's a great deal of fragility in our minds around fish, and there's so much confrontation because of smells, odors, coldness, wetness. You know, even just the bones, you know, fillets strike fear into most people, let alone giving them fish liver on toast out of the book. It's, you know, there's a great deal of confrontation there. I think we've built it up into something far more tedious and complex than what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
There is a huge amount of labor in fish to do it in the way that I process fish, like to handle a fish dry. You know, it's a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not saying that everybody should process fish the way that I do, but I feel like certain parts of my work, I hope, not only in restaurants but on like a very big scale, can get adapted so that we take fewer fish from the water, because the methods that I'm suggesting say that we will get a greater shelf life and we'll be able to maximize the potential of a fish. Because a round fish at the moment, we're only yielding half of it as the fillet.
So it's 50% waste from every fish.
At best.
At best.
I mean, you're looking at other fish in Australia, and I'm sure there's some over here, where we'll yield 37% fillet from a fish. And so then the rest is, you know, yes, you can make very expensive fish stock from those bones and things, but you know, there's only so much stock you can make and sell. You know, 91% now of a fish we've made, you know, delicious and celebrated and accepted and, you know, for a Western palate.
Stick around to hear more from Josh Nyland, including his inventive ways for cooking some of the lesser used parts of the fish.
I mean, I don't think there's any other cooking ingredient or product that would have that level of waste. Like nothing else would have and that. It would be tolerable, you know. Like
it's unbelievable that we've globally normalized it.
Yeah, completely.
And but in the East, I must say as well, in the East and Middle Eastern countries, all throughout Asia and even Africa, like there's a celebration of utilizing the whole fish, mm-hmm. and they've been doing it for so long, for mm-hmm. millennia. They've consumed the whole fish. So what I'm suggesting isn't brand new.
No.
Like there is people out there doing the right thing with regards to that. But how does the Eastern way translate into a Western demographic? Like how do we celebrate the eyeballs? How do we celebrate those very confrontational, texturally uncomfortable parts mm-hmm. of the fish into the way that we consume food in the West? So,
Do you think that like our reliance with supermarkets is the sort of problem with that? Because you're dictated to
yes
by what species of fish you're and, only and being what cut like what fillet and what portion what size what little bit you're
that's
getting
right.
of it
yeah you're being subjected to you know maybe 10 species of fish like at best you know yeah globally we're only really looking at a handful of species because that's you know what's what consumer confidence has.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just, you know, salmon, like back home in Australia, 25% of Australians consume fish in a week, and of that, 16% consume salmon.
Yeah.
So there's when it's in front of you, like a chicken thigh that's boneless, skinless, and there, mm-hmm. you develop a repertoire. Like you develop methods,
you
gain significant self-confidence that when your in-laws come around to cook them a meal, you're going to get that chicken thigh and you're going to get a bunch of broccolini and you're going to do the old, you know, Uncle Ben's out of the microwave and put it with some chicken and there's dinner, you know, but you're not going to go out and buy a blue mackerel, butterfly it and then, you know, pan fry it and put it with who knows what. But if there was a space like you know, fishmongers and things, like the communication by the customer needs to become sharper
mm-hmm.
and we need to ask and we need to, you know, not demand, but we need to get in front of people that can you take the bones out of that for me? Can you cut it in this way so that I can feel more confident?
Yeah, yeah. It's people, part of a discussion.
Like there's butchers out there cutting cheeks from, you know, a cow's head out the back because they were going to take it home for their supper, but, you know, it's there.
Yeah,
they've got it. And these people are spending from 2 o'clock in the morning in the cold finding the best fish.
Mm-hmm.
So there is passion there.
Yeah,
there is
yeah.
a burning desire to be around fish and something about fish for these people that makes them tick.
Mm-hmm.
If you communicate your desire to have something delicious and seasonal and wonderful, there's a certain part of their brain that will be excited by that.
Mm-hmm.
And here, try this red mullet. It's going to be great, but let me bone it out for you. Let me butterfly it. Let me, you know, do this.
So, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I think that was what was really interesting about you, but it was the sort of trying to change the wording of like, it's what you, you know, you refer to it, or some people refer to it as a fishmonger.
Yes.
As opposed to a fish butcher, whereas you've got the fish butchery.
Yes.
Whereas a monger sells something, whereas a butcher but really you're doing the same thing as any
Correct.
Butcher would do. You're getting the whole animal in, you're breaking it down into cuts and
that's right. And if you look at it on paper, it's fishmongers deal and trade in, well, mongers in general mm-hmm. deal and trade in a specific commodity. And then you look at butchery and it's the dressing and slaughtering of an animal in readiness to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
So then why is it that we can't blur those lines and push the two together? Because I feel they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I just like the idea of what the meat butchery offers up to the customer, the mm-hmm. conversation, the, you know, the gestures of this is how I would cook it. Here, I'm going to, you know, trust this beautiful cut of meat for you. And here's 180 degrees for 35 minutes, rest it for 10 minutes, then put it with some potatoes. Why can't that communication happen in a fish shop? Now, I'm sure there's a number of fish shops around the world that do offer that service,
mm-hmm.
but let's normalize that into everyday.
Everyday life.
Yeah.
No, I thought that was really interesting.
No,
that was
thanks.
Really cool. So you celebrate using the whole fish. When you come up with dishes, how many like iterations do they have to go through? Is it are some things easier to make really delicious than others? Like, because I know that you do something with fish eyes, which is actually my editor Laura ate the other night and was cool. Like mind blown. You know?
No, tell good. Us a bit about them? No, so you know, and this isn't to sound at all arrogant, but the day that I thought of that, I woke up one morning and I just thought it'd be wonderful to try to make a prawn cracker out of fish eyes. And we went about that in a very standard way. We were like, okay, we need a base, which is protein. Mm-hmm. And so we blended the eyeballs and then we passed it through a tammy and made a very fine, horrible-looking grey porridge.
Yeah.
And then we beat in tapioca flour to it. And then we spread it out nice and thin. We steamed it, we dried it, and then we deep-fried it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we resulted in was this prawn cracker that was very alien-esque and very bubbled and quite dramatic. And we started selling, like serving them at the restaurant. And people's fascination towards the shape and the texture and the saltiness and the crunch outweighed anybody's thinking that they were eating fish eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a secondary. And that was what came then as good humor. And the fact then they had a story to go away and say, I ate fish eyes at St. Peter. And,
yeah,
you know, they could have a laugh. And that's part, that's food. That's a wonderful thing to create. But, fish offal, using that in charcuterie, I've found extremely challenging for both myself and Paul Farag, my manager at the butchery. We both found we still find it to be very challenging to manipulate fish organs into whether it's sausages, like black pudding, mm-hmm. making fish black pudding.
Yeah, that really intrigued me. I would love to try that one day.
Yeah, like
and I suppose. Is fish blood just as irony and like is it the similar product?
It's similar, like we have to use some fish fat cut into it.
Yeah.
But I do feel that it's even more mild than pig's blood pudding. I was expecting this whack of you know, iodine mineral kind of almost tainted by that metallic taste, it was very clean, and I'm also saying that you need an excellent fish to be doing that, obviously. But using fish milt, like shirako in Japanese cuisine,
mm-hmm.
the fish sperm, we've made mortadella sausage out of it.
That's mad.
And to make a mortadella out of that was very exciting and delicious, and we already had a fish liver pate under our belt. And so we thought, well, let's put the two of them together and do a banh mi sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've now got a banh mi sandwich on at Fish Butchery on the takeaway menu, which to me is so exciting to see people coming in and interacting with a banh mi sandwich. Like, it's very normal and they're excited to have their lunch. And then they walk out of the shop with this fish sperm, fish liver banh mi sandwich. And I have a giggle to myself thinking, well, wow, this is amazing to think that people have normalized this now.
That's it. Like when you go somewhere where you trust what they're doing, and at the bottom line, it's delicious. Then there's the squeamishness sort of goes out of the window, doesn't it?
Exactly. Even making a yellowfin tuna cheeseburger from sustainable tuna, and we cut the red muscle from the loin of the tuna, and we put it through a mincer, and then we shape a patty, and then we grill it over charcoal. And what you end up with is something that honestly I would think you would struggle to pick between a beef burger and a tuna burger because of visually how similar it is, but also the meatiness of the aged tuna is incredible. So there's huge potential. It's Pandora's box. When you start building a repertoire that is in line with meat butchery, but you're playing with fish,
mm-hmm.
you all of a sudden create a lane that's never existed. And you have this wonderful opportunity, as I feel I do right now, to inspire a group of chefs that there's never been a more captive time to have, you know, this conversation around what's being thrown in the bin.
Mm. That's what struck me about the book was that it seems, whether deliberate or not, but it just seems so perfect for the conversation around food at the moment.
Yeah.
And it took you to put it together. But on my Instagram, definitely everyone's talking about it.
No.
It just really has struck a conversation. Like, waste is obviously a big thing that everyone's talking about, but like, I don't think people would even considered fish in the waste, like in the category of that, you know?
Because it's such a habitual routine for a chef. And I know that you can attest to that being a chef, but to pick up your knife and go about the tasks that a fish sets in front of you, your mentor and my mentor would have shown you a particular way of how to process a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that, generationally speaking, has always been the case. And so it's this learning from mentor to mentor, and it's just you don't question your mentor.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't question who's telling you how to do this. And if it works, or like on the surface it works, or you've built a system that can navigate your way through day one to day four with this fish, and then also have normalized in your brain, okay, well, that's just not good enough anymore, and so off it goes, and maybe we'll make fish cakes out of a staff meal. Lost my train of thought, but...
When you were writing it and putting this together, did you realize how boundary pushing it was going to be? And like just in your day to day, what you were doing? Like, and was it difficult to step away from what your mentors had and be like, actually, I'm going to do it differently to how I was always taught? Or?
Yeah, I feel like the mentor that I had in Stephen Hodges at Fishface, he was very much suggesting that water was the enemy as well. And that was something that was tattooed into the back of my brain from mm-hmm. a very young age that, you know, you're not to process fish with water. So I had good learning with that. But I was always curious as to when I was gutting a fish that I would weigh the organs and everything that was being tossed in the bin, mm-hmm. I would just weigh it, and then I would get a dollar amount, and then I would mark that up by four, and then have a look at what the restaurant value was on what was going into the bin. And it was fairly startling.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was in some cases just shocking to think that we've just, thrown all this money in the bin. But, I think that's been the biggest thing that chefs have taken away from it, just the fact that there's opportunity in there that can help manage a small business. Because, I mean, a lot of what I've done is to keep bums on seats at the restaurant, yes, with the conversation around dry aging and bringing good humour through cutting fish to interpret it as meat. But the main agenda here is like to discuss, you know, how to handle a fish better so that we get a longer shelf life and so that we take fewer fish from the water, but also celebrate more diverse amount of species. So, yes, there are people that are slightly, you know, negative to the sense that I'm saying that the system is flawed, but that's fine. I feel you know, a certain sense of confidence that, you know, it's practice now. For 18 months I've run Fish Butchery, and for 3 years I've run the restaurant. And through following these methods and techniques, we've had great success both financially and also, in the fish that we're serving and the flavour profiles and the deliciousness of fish. Mm-hmm. And we haven't been throwing fish in the bin. So,
yeah. Mm. And do you... There's a lot of comparison with Fergus Ennison from St John. How do you feel about that comparison?
No, that's tremendously flattering, and I don't feel I'm worthy to be held in the same category as Fergus. But, I mean, he's taken 25 years to make commercially acceptable, like to have cheeks and snouts and tails and things in ready and available in most supermarkets. Mm. Him and many, many others who have flown that flag have literally pushed their way forward into the most common of food stores now, and like I said, have normalized these ingredients and have brought great desirability to them and forced the price of these secondary cuts up, which is a wonderful thing. And I imagine has alleviated those prime cuts, like alleviated the pressure from those prime mm-hmm. cuts. Maybe I'm living in a bubble and that hasn't filtered out far enough, but I feel like globally speaking, Fergus is held in such, you know, high reverence for his work. And I feel like I'm at the very, very beginning of something quite unique with the way that we handle fish. And if I can achieve half of what Fergus has done in 25 years, then I'll be in a wonderful position of hopefully positive change with the way that we interact with fish.
And I honestly think you will, because from reading the book, I could tell it was groundbreaking.
Oh, thank you.
And on that note, I think we'll call it quits.
Otherwise, we'll be here all day.
Yeah, no, we definitely could be. I could talk all day. Oh. But thank you so much for joining me, taking some time.
Very kind. Thank you.
Cheers.
So that was the Old Magazine podcast. If you liked this episode, please head over to iTunes and leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to find out more information on things in this episode, you can visit our website, olivemagazine.com. You can pick up a copy of our new November issue on the newsstand now, or go and download the app version. Bye for now, and we'll be back next week with more food and drink chat.